you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, since we deal with social and political trends on this podcast, we have dealt with sports in many ways recently. We did one on whether college athletes should be paid. We did one on FanDuel and DraftKings
betting
and its impact on our society. Sports is ever present. I mean, it's a huge part of the economy. It's a huge part of the way people idle their time away. And so it is really important. And I've thought of it in the context of even labor negotiations, how much sports has changed over the years and its impact in the society. So you think about it, John. Unions in the private sector have really been struggling for a good period of time. As the nature of work has changed, a lot of people in the gig economy, they're doing creative work. It's hard to standardize it and give similar benefits and wages because what one person does related to the other is so different. And yet, in one sector, that being sports, professional sports, the union, the organization, the association of players, has never been stronger.
Interesting. Technology is also changing sports a lot. With now they can measure how these players perform.
Oh, yeah. We did another podcast about the Golden State Warriors, looking at why were they so dominant for such a period, and their metrics, their analytics, you know, the Sabre analytics, are so different. And so your value as a player is not what you and I see. We're watching one game.
Right.
At our own very superficial level. But those who are analyzing the benefit of that player to them, how quickly can he get up for his jumper? What has he lost in the last 3 years as it relates to his speed to, you know, one side of the court and to the other? I mean, just these different metrics. But that's all goes into the analysis of what is the value of the player to the team. And do we want to re-sign him? Do we want to let him into free agency? And don't forget, John, just decades ago, the player was really almost owned by the team for life.
That's true. But that's changed a lot.
Has that changed a lot? Particularly in the NBA, where guys say, hey, I want to play with you. Larry Rifkin wants to play with John Krofcik, and we're going to build our own super team. It's pretty fascinating to see those changes.
But the unions are still big.
Oh, they're huge, John. I mean, they've negotiated these incredible deals. And, of course, recently we lost David Stern, who was an incredible commissioner of basketball, who really brought basketball into the sunshine, brought it into such a serious position within the world of sports. And, of course, he always respected the players because he realized that they were the product.
Right.
And you got to treat the product
well.
People
are watching them.
Well, nobody's coming to see the general manager dribble. Let's be honest about that. So Jim Quinn is a fascinating guy who's written a book called Don't Be Afraid to Win, How Free Agency Changed the Business of Pro Sports. And, John, you talk about a gentleman who has a unique perspective. Listen to this, John. He has been involved sitting at the negotiating table in all four major sports on the side of the players over his career. Does that give him a unique perspective?
I guess he has the most unique perspective. He's in there negotiating for them.
Exactly. And we're talking about hockey, baseball, basketball, and, of course, the giant of them all, football. He's a successful lawyer and negotiator, and with a particular emphasis on free agency and what it has meant to the world of sports. Now, we know that, again, unions have not been that successful recently in the private sector in America, though there is some inkling that they are coming back to some extent. I've been reading articles. You saw that strike at General Motors. That is a rarity today. It used to be pretty commonplace in our society. So I'm wondering how many of them are looking at the sports leagues and saying, wow, look at the power of coming together and what they've been able to negotiate on their own behalf. Or maybe because these athletes are so special, so unique, and such a small number of them exist, that maybe it's not applicable to everyday life in America in the workplace. I'm not certain, John.
Well, I don't know. I think unions, a lot of them forgot the working guy. And, you know, unfortunately in America, greed is a big thing. And I think the unions were taking more for themselves and forgot the working guy. And I think that's why the unions are kind of have fallen on, you know, people want to get out of unions. People see that the benefit for a union is not really what it used to be.
Though, of course, that doesn't pertain in the public sector still.
Right.
Because they have been able to negotiate some incredible arrangements.
Right.
But with that said, I think that's an important point, John, because what we learn in this podcast is that some of the leaders of these various player associations, and we got to know their names like Marvin Miller and others, because they have been so successful and so aware of what it is that these unions and these players want and what they think they deserve, and they see the pie that is there to be split up, and they've been very aggressive, and they've been very successful. So don't be afraid to win, John, today on America Trends.
With me on the line is Jim Quinn, and he's just an incredible lawyer who's been involved in trials and arbitration, mediation, and at one time or another, he was the lead counsel for the major sports players associations, and you've done just about everything you can do to represent athletes in America, Jim. It's been a remarkable career. How would you look back on it?
Luck put me there in the first place. I was a young lawyer and back in the early 70s and at a law firm in New York that happened to be representing the NBA Players Union in its first fight for free agency. Somebody, one of the senior lawyers asked me to get involved, and I started with what became known as the Oscar Robertson lawsuit against the NBA, and from there managed to get involved in football and baseball and hockey. And it's been a lot of fun.
I can imagine. Now, you titled the book "Don't Be Afraid to Win." Were they afraid to win at one point? I mean, we all remember the stories of some of my favorite players growing up, because I'm a little bit older now, and I can remember when they used to have jobs in the off season, when they weren't paid terribly well, when they were really just under that reserve clause, and they all were owned by various teams and could not have the movement that they have today in free agency. So I remember all of that. So what changed the tide over the years?
The first weapon that the players associations and the unions were able to use was the antitrust laws, the tax of this reserve system that you referred to. Basically, as some of your listeners may know, but many probably don't, back before the fights that the unions brought, players were basically serfs. They were tied to their teams even after their contracts were up. They didn't have the ability to go into the marketplace and negotiate with other teams. They were barred from doing that. Almost simultaneously in the early 1970s, both in basketball and in baseball, first with what became known as the Curt Flood lawsuit in baseball, and in basketball it was the Oscar Robertson lawsuit. Those systems were under attack, were ultimately able in basketball to get a very favorable settlement that became known as the Oscar Robertson settlement, which was the first crack in the free agency wall. And similarly in baseball, although Curt Flood's case itself was thrown out by the Supreme Court, Marvin Miller, who was the head of the union back then, persisted in an arbitration and ultimately was able to obtain free agency in baseball virtually simultaneously with what we did in basketball.
I thought it was fascinating that you talked about the first player strike in sports history changing professional sports forever, and it lasted only 21 minutes. I don't even recall that, but just remind people, very interesting story about the NBA.
this is back in the mid-60s when the NBA union was really fledgling, just virtually starting, and the players were trying to get a modest pension plan. This is way before free agency. They just wanted a few bucks after they retired, and the NBA owners had refused to negotiate about it. And it turned out that for the first time in 1964, the NBA All-Star Game was going to be on national television, and that was a big deal for the NBA back then. It was scheduled to go on a Tuesday night in snowy Boston at 8 p.m., and the players, both the West and the East teams, got together in separate locker rooms and decided with Larry Fleischer, who was the then executive director of the union, that they were not going to come out and play unless the owners agreed. And sure enough, 8 o'clock came and there was no players on the court. Finally, after some heated arguments in the hallways, the owners relented and agreed to give the players a pension plan. And at 8:21, the players came out and played the game. And ironically, it was Oscar Robertson who was the most valuable player in the game.
Now, a guy who's making $60,000 a year, who loves sports, watches it as much as he can, recognizes that he can only take his kids to a game once or twice a year because it's so darn expensive. And he looks at these, what he calls maybe pampered players, and has little sympathy, or hears that this is a contract year, so-and-so is going to play an awful lot harder. I mean, what do you say to the average sports fan?
First of all, I learned this a long time ago. You know, these are very special athletes. There are very few of them. They're just no different than other kinds of entertainers and actors who make a lot of money. They really have, since they all have relatively short careers, football could be 3 or 4 years, maybe a little longer in baseball, unclear, you know, in basketball, very small rosters. Not a lot of guys are going to get to that level. The reality is that you, at any given time, you're going to try to get as much money as you possibly can. The players don't set the ticket prices. That's set by owners, and most of the owners are billionaires. So if they wanted to lower the prices, they could clearly lower the prices, and it wouldn't have such an impact on them. So I think, you know, fans should look, if they have any anger, it should be at the owners, not at the players.
Well, sometimes the owners have to kind of protect themselves from their own excesses and their own fantasies about being an athlete, I think. You said that you regret having a role in a salary cap. Explain that.
Salary cap came in basketball in the early 1980s, and at the time, it was largely because there were a significant number of teams, perhaps as many as a half dozen, that were essentially bankrupt. We on the union side recognized, after having thoroughly reviewed their books and became convinced that they weren't lying to us for a change, we decided to put a salary cap in place. It really, at the time, we thought it was going to be a temporary fix for some number of years, and we tied it to increased revenues so that the players would also benefit if revenues increased. As it turned out in basketball, as we know, revenues increased an enormous amount. Now players are going to be making close to $10 million a year on average because of the huge revenue increases. On reflection, it seems to me that there's really no need for a salary cap. You just let the market decide. The owners need to be smarter to be able to protect themselves. Sure, they're going to make some mistakes, but I'm a free market guy, so I think players should have the ability to earn what they can without being subject to a salary cap.
I was talking to somebody who really teaches negotiation the other day, and we were talking more about the public sector and leadership in America today. And
yes,
he said that you have to manage agreements. Even though you might sign something, it doesn't mean that that is really what ultimately occurs. And you said in the book that owners always try to find ways to evade agreements. I mean, how do you monitor that there is actual, you know, fairness and, you know, sticking to the agreements that have been made?
Well, that's a great question. I think what the unions today, because the collective bargaining agreements are so complex, the unions now have significant staff that oversee certainly the issues relating to the salary cap with, you know, counting of revenues to make sure that all the revenues that are supposed to be included in the deal, which affect the size of the salary cap, are properly accounted for. It's a much more complicated issue today than it was when we first got involved and began to put these collective bargaining agreements together. The initial collective bargaining agreements were a few pages long. Now they're hundreds and hundreds of pages long. It's like the IRS.
The book is called Don't Be Afraid to Win, How Free Agency Changed the Business of Pro Sports. Jim Quinn, who's negotiated a lot of those contracts, is with us. And Jim, you know, when we look at, workers' rights today, it seems as if organizing is almost passé in the private sector, and it's so rare. And I'm wondering whether the unions, the players' associations, if anything that you have learned in that sector might be applied to the way workers overall in America are being treated today. Are there any lessons to be shared as a result of your success?
Professional sports unions are unique in the sense that you negotiate floors, minimum salaries, and so forth. But because of free agency, individual contract negotiations that go on above the minimums, and so probably somewhat less applicable to other unions. But I think the most important lesson that I've learned is, particularly since in sports you're going up against very wealthy, well-heeled owners, most of them now are billionaires, that you just have to hang together. You're going to have to be making sure that you have solidarity and are willing to fight hard to make sure that players in our unions are not only fairly compensated, but also are treated fairly.
What about the public's role in any of these settlements? When there is a long absence of competition, there's a lot of frustration. Replacement players at times have been used. I'm not certain how often they have been, or if it's only limited to football. I do recall that. But does the public have any role in getting to a settlement when there is a long labor crisis? And you do point to some of the concerns that you had about various times when there were strikes or job actions.
You know, the bottom line is the answer is really no. The public just has to get along. There aren't going to be games. You know, probably the worst, most difficult union management fight was in hockey back in 2005, where they lost a whole season. And obviously hockey fans were very upset with that. That is an example of both sides being unwilling to compromise. One of the things I've learned over time is that eventually, you know, even if you're not going to get everything you want and both sides are going to be unhappy, whatever the deal is, you're going to have to reach a deal and compromise to get it, to make it happen.
You say in the book that sports has become the vehicle through which we discuss race, free speech, gender roles, patriotism, sexual orientation, drugs, and violence. That seems to put a lot of weight on the behavior of the athletes, the owners. I mean, how much is America today, in a time of great division, really either hanging together or putting more and investing more in sports than they might otherwise, looking for something to believe in?
You know, it's a fair question. I think that the reality is that it is true that many of these issues now get focused on in the context of sports, simply because it's public and there's a lot of publicity and people follow these things on a 24/7, 365 basis, unlike it was 20, you know, decades ago. But in the end, and I try to get this point across in the epilogue, the fact is that whether or not people come from red states or blue states and or Catholic or Muslim or Jewish or whatever, the reality is that people just enjoy watching sports. And it's a way for many of us to bridge the differences that we have. We can get mad at the player from Cleveland banging the quarterback head with a helmet. That obviously is something that's out of bounds. But the bottom line is that for most sports fans, you just enjoy watching the game, whatever the game may be.
Having said that, football, and you acknowledge this in the postscript to your book, is in some trouble, both because of the off-field activities of many of the players and, of course, the response of the NFL to that, but even more dramatically, the concussions, the violence. What do you think we should be looking at there? Because the NFL really has been the driver of so much in the American culture, and you do see it having its issues going forward as a result of some of these problems.
Yeah, look, I think the NFL is trying to focus on the concussion issue. I'm not sure that there's a lot more that they can do. They're changing some of the rules, trying to make it safer. Online is a violent game, and unless and until fandom decides they don't want to watch it anymore, which is really what happened with boxing, I don't see the NFL, at least in the near term, having any significant problems. You do find that on the coast and in suburbs, more and more parents are concerned about their sons playing high school football or even junior football, but in what I'll call flyover country, that's not really the case. So there's still going to be plenty of athletes who are going to play high school and college football and be ready to play in the NFL for a long time to come.
When we look at the stakes in all of this, if in fact we as Americans are investing a lot of our hopes and aspirations in really fair competition, tell me, what do you think all of this legalized gambling, FanDuel, DraftKings, what's the impact? Because I think a lot of people are surprised to see that the leagues themselves are buying into some of these services, and some might argue with some of the scandals in the past, going back to the Black Sox, I guess, that it would be best to have the two divided, but they seem to be coming together. Explain, number one, the impact of that financially for the players, but also what you think about some of the concerns ethically going forward that we'll have to watch.
Yeah, look, I think the leagues are going to have to be very careful to make sure that, that nothing untoward like the Black Sox or the basketball scandals in the 50s occurs. But keep in mind that that kind of gambling has been legal in Las Vegas for 50 years. They've been betting on sports. It's just not been done on a state-by-state basis. Also, the fact is that players today are making a lot of money. I think it's going to be really hard to get a player who's making $4 or $5 million a year to, in any sport, throw a game. They'd have to pay him a lot of money. Where they have to be concerned of, I think, is probably with refs who are not making a lot of money. He did have that incident in the NBA some years ago with the referee named Donaghy. So they are going to definitely have to watch much more carefully now that they're embracing sports betting. But in the end, I don't think it's going to have a huge impact. And I'm not even sure how much money it's going to generate for either the leagues or the players. Most of the money is going to go to the states.
Jim Quinn is with us. Don't be afraid to win. Jim, when we do look at television, cable television, over-the-air television, and particularly ESPN, what has the impact of this sports 24/7, of course, talk radio? What's the impact then overall, both on the pot of money available and the way sports is perceived in America?
Money part has obviously been a huge impact. I mean, you know, rights back in the day were worth, you know, a few million, then a few hundred million. Now it's billions and billions of television rights, whether it's cable or network, or now you've got streaming. And much of that's going to, you know, who knows with what technology is going to be out there 10 years from now. But knowing the NFL and the other sports, they'll figure out ways to earn money one way or the other, new revenue streams. I think the on the broader question, the reality is that because of talk radio, because of the ESPN, Fox Sports, whatever, there's a much more focus on what goes on in sports on a day-to-day basis. And with regard to all of the sports, their really coverage is all year long now. It's not just a seasonal thing. Because of free agency, the draft, and so forth, you have interest in your favorite sport for the entire year. And the level of coverage is astronomical. When we used to do deals back in the day, in the 70s and 80s, no one gave a damn. You know, we'd be in a conference room for days, what the salary cap would be or how free agency was supposed to work. And once a deal was done, it'd be two paragraphs in the bottom of the sports, you know, NBA signs new union agreement. That was it. Now, you know, it's on television. It's 24 hours a day. I'd like to go back to the old days.
What about the element of race? There were some players, and they still say it, don't use the term owner. It reminds us of a role in the past that we don't want to go back to. And you do say that in the NFL, there was this saying, because they can be really tough in their negotiations, we can always get more cattle. What do you say about the way that players perceive the owners or those who do run these teams and the way those who run the teams look at their players?
Well, I think today the relationships are a lot better than they were back in the day because players now have the ability to move. They have to be treated with a level of respect that back in the day they didn't have to be treated with. The owners, as one owner once told Gene Upshaw, head of the union, that they were the ranchers and we were the cattle and they just get more cattle. They don't have that attitude anymore.
And what about the ability for players to go to their agents? The role of the agent, of course, many of us saw it in Jerry Maguire some time back, and there are these celebrity star agents. What role do they play in all of this?
You know, I've always been a believer that the agents do play an important role since they are individually representing players, and the good ones fight hard to make sure that they're clients, their players, get the best possible deal, and they're working closely with unions. Today we have oversight, agent oversight in all the unions. Problems of the past have gone away. For the most part, the agents play a very important role in the system.
And what about competition? You talked about lawsuits related to antitrust. Where do we stand today? If somebody wanted to establish a new league, and we will talk about the efforts in the past that involve one Donald J. Trump. But tell us, you know, how difficult or how easy it is for that competition to flourish and the importance of that potentially down the road.
I think it has been very difficult. There have been a number of failed attempts in football in particular show how difficult it is. And part of it over the years has been the NFL, for example, has dominated the networks in such a way that it's hard for somebody else to, you know, break through. I do think now, because there are so many new outlets with streaming, Netflix, and we've got now Disney, we have Apple TV, there may be more of a possibility for a new type league, and I've heard that the XFL is now coming back. There may be some possibility for rival leagues to emerge because they'll have new outlet, television outlets, which are really critical to professional sports. Of course, as you alluded to, there was one effort by the a sports league known as the United States Football League, the USFL, to compete. And their initial concept was to play in the spring. And it was actually working out pretty well. They signed some really good players, Herschel Walker, among others. They had several Heisman Trophy winners. They played for several seasons, reasonably successful. And then along came one Donald Trump. And as I say in the book, I refer to that Trump's $3 league because he convinced the USFL to try to move to the fall to directly compete with the NFL, an idiotic idea. And they put on a lawsuit, and the ultimate lawsuit, the jury awarded the USFL $1 times three because it was an antitrust lawsuit. So they got $3, and they also went out of business. So the whole story is told in the book, and it's an interesting story.
And you said, I could have told you a lot back then already about Donald Trump. League mergers over the years and the impact, the NFL, AFL, NBA, ABA, what impact has that had on the competition and on the players?
One of the reasons we fought in basketball to block the merger was because we wanted to continue competition between the leagues. But given the fact that we were able to obtain free agency, we do have competition. And the fact that their mergers did occur is no longer really relevant.
What about the decertification of any of these players' associations? I mean, again, I was talking about the private sector in America and overall. the strength that the owners have had in keeping unions at bay. I mean, the public sector is something a bit different, but any possibility or any attempts at decertification of any of these unions, and do you think that that would be met today with such impossible resistance that they wouldn't even try that?
Yeah, I think it's tougher now than it was when we did it. The owners have come up with new arguments, but I still, at least in sports, it's still a possibility, because if you do decertify, you get back your antitrust rights, and these systems like a salary cap, absent an agreement by the union, are clearly, you know, illegal. They're price fixing. So decertification is something that players' unions will continue to look at in order to gain leverage, because these negotiations really are all about leverage.
Which is the strongest of the players' associations, as you see it?
Today, certainly the baseball union continues to be a strong union. It has been since the days of Marvin Miller. I think the basketball just finished a collective bargaining round a couple of years ago. They remain strong after they had some problems. Football will now be standing up to the NFL owners in another year or so, and I suspect they're going to hang tough. And we'll see what happens in hockey. Hockey usually ends up in a lockout because the commissioner seems to like them, but we'll see what happens next round.
You did point out in the book that when Dr. J was traded, ticket holders wanted to sue the Nets. I recently went to a conclave that was held by, believe it or not, Ralph Nader. He's still going strong, talking about tort reform. And he tried to organize fans, has set up an organization for fans' rights as it relates to baseball safety issues, lots of terrible incidents that we've seen of late, pricing, and a whole range of situations that he says fans are not getting a fair shake. Any of those efforts to organize fans, what's your take on them?
I think it's very difficult. There have been many, many cases where fans have tried to bring lawsuits, and they've inevitably failed because they don't really have standing. It's a business. They're just customers. And as long as there isn't any level of price fixing on tickets and so forth, the fans are going to have to deal with the fact that these sports are run by billionaires.
Jim Quinn, I'm wondering if you've gotten any calls. Obviously, the new California law, and then some mild response, though some are saying that it was a lot of, hat and no cattle, getting back to the cattle reference, about what the NCAA said they were going to do in terms of allowing players in college athletics to benefit from their likeness or use of their image. What do you think is going to happen there? What's the impact on sports overall if, in fact, college athletes do get some form of compensation, whether it's by the teams themselves or whether it's by sponsors?
I think you have to make a distinction on the name and likeness issue. It looks like the NCAA has finally buckled on this issue. It was silly that they had the rules in the first place. And once you had several states who had now passed laws, starting with the one in California, I think it was inevitable that the NCAA was going to have to fold. But overall, the impact on that, I don't think is going to be all that significant, simply because there's not that many athletes, college athletes. There's a few in basketball, a few quarterbacks perhaps in football. But for the most part, the local gas station is not going to pay the second string guard for his name and likeness. And so you're talking about a handful of players that will actually earn any money as a result of being able to earn money for their name and likeness. On the other front, the issue of compensation on a broader level, I think that they're going to have to come to some understanding of getting the players who now are essentially working full-time for an entire season because they practice and so forth. They can't get jobs in the summer or on holidays, that they come up with a system where the players get some stipend, some relatively modest $10,000 or $15,000, to make up for the fact that they can't otherwise earn money. And I think if they do something like that the whole issue is going to largely go away.
Can you see sports expanding or contracting in the period ahead? You talked about some of the concerns that you have about the different leagues, and we can talk about that as we close. But do you think there's likely more expansion, contraction? What do you see?
You know, I think you're going to see there's a couple of new football leagues that are trying to get put themselves together, and there's some discussion of another spring league that, you know, if people have enough money, they can put into it. It's tough to compete with owners in the NFL or the NBA and any of these sports simply because they're entrenched and they have the deals with television. So I don't see any massive expansion.
We do see that attendance has been dropping off in baseball. If you look at some of the highlights on ESPN and the other channels, oftentimes it looks like there's nobody there. So how important is it for the live fan experience, particularly against the backdrop of the big screen television experience now available to people?
No, it's a good question. You know, I think that one of the things they need to do, whether it's television or live, they've got to speed the game up. It's just, you can't have four-hour baseball. I love baseball, but it takes too long. And they've got to get the average game back down, certainly under 3 hours and probably under 2.5 hours.
When you talked about, in your closing of the book, the various strengths of the leagues and weaknesses, you said hockey just hasn't penetrated the U.S. in the way that it needs to. Baseball is getting older and whiter, though the Latino influence may help to blunt some of that. You talked about football, the problems that we discussed earlier, and you said that the NBA is probably best poised, given its pace, given its hipness in our culture. Tell us where you do feel all the leagues stand at this moment in time.
Well, obviously the NFL still dominates. They, you know, you just look at both their television revenues and their attendance and the fact that large number of fans continue to be huge followers of the NFL. The NBA has now really become number two. I think they've eclipsed baseball for some of the reasons you just mentioned. Hockey and baseball are going to have to continue to fight for more attention as time goes on. But I don't see any of them, you know, let's not take the crying towels out for any of the owners right now. Everyone's going to be fine.
Well, I can certainly take out the crying towel for my vaunted New York Knicks, that I can say. Well, listen, Jim Quinn, an honor to have you on today. Don't Be Afraid to Win, How Free Agency Changed the Business of Pro Sports. Thank you so much for being with us today on